This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, December 24th, 2009. From New York, this is Dorian Marina. Today we're taking you to Jordan for an exclusive documentary on the plight of Iraqi refugees. Stay with us. Iraqis make up the world's largest population of refugees. The 2003 U.S.-led invasion of Iraq released a wave of violence and economic instability, and brought with it the destruction of key infrastructure and the near collapse of basic services. More than 2.7 million Iraqis have been displaced within their borders, and another 2 million have fled their country, largely to Syria and Jordan. Today we bring you a special FSRN documentary, Guests in the Waiting Room, Iraqi Refugees in Jordan, produced by Hanan Tabara and Salam Talib. Please stay with us.
One of every eight Iraqis has been uprooted, according to the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. This accounts for the largest long-term population movement in the Arab world since the Palestinian exodus in 1948. Most of the Iraqi refugees are hosted by Syria and Jordan, but the countries are not equipped to meet the needs of all those arriving.
My name is Mohammed. I was born in 1989. I am an Iraqi youth. I am 19 years old. I wish I could be like other youth and achieve my dream. I live in Amman, Jordan.
Mohammed is one of many forced migrants and refugees that the Kingdom of Jordan has received. With a population of 5.7 million, Jordan has an estimated 2 million Palestinian refugees and 750,000 Iraqis. According to the 2007 Forced Migration Review, Jordan currently hosts the largest number of refugees per capita in the world. Historically, Jordan has welcomed Armenians, Circassians, and significant numbers of Palestinians, and more recently, Iraqis fleeing war and persecution. While much of the outside world considers Iraqi asylum seekers to be refugees, they have no corresponding status in Jordan. Jordan is not party to the United Nations Convention relating to the status of refugees, which defines who qualifies as a refugee and outlines their guaranteed rights as well as the responsibilities of nations granting asylum. Iraqis in Jordan are accommodated as guests, but behind this poetic designation lies an uncertain legal limbo. Through his capacity in health services organization, Dr. Jalal Damra works closely with refugee communities living in Jordan.
Jordan's refusal to sign on to the protocol has to do with various complications that deal with Jordan's geographic situation in the Middle East and other political complications.
While some wealthy Iraqis have been able to tap their savings to live comfortably, the less affluent are struggling to survive. We went to Jordan to bring you some of their stories. A smiling woman, Khayzaran, welcomed us through a green gate into a small yellow-painted living room. Despite her financial difficulties, Khayzaran maintains her sense of hospitality to her guest. She sends to her daughter to prepare tea.
Our possessions are still in Iraq. We had a house and a car. After the problems that happened to my husband, we had to leave quickly. We left everything in Iraq. His family sold some of our belongings to help us flee.
Cautious, Khayzaran, who doesn't want her full name used for security reasons, recalls the details of leaving Najaf. She told us that in a day and night, her family had to pack their lives into a few suitcases and quickly flee to Jordan. Her husband had received credible death threats. Now, Khayzaran lives in a quiet, working poor neighborhood in East Amman with her two daughters and her two younger sons. Her entire family, including her husband and eldest son, applied for resettlement in Austria. But because certain documents were missing, only her husband and eldest son were accepted. That was 3 years ago. Khayzaran and the rest of her family reapplied for resettlement. and they continue to wait for a response.
Their father has been away for years. He was resettled in Austria when they were children. He missed their childhood. Hajar was 3 years old when he left. When he sees her on the video cam, he bemoans her childhood. He missed it in its entirety. He sometimes tells me, "I wish I saw what words were her first."
The war has broken apart many Iraqi families. Family members have been killed, disappeared, displaced, or separated through the resettlement process. Khulood, who goes by her first name only, worked as a translator for the U.S. military. After the militia threatened her entire family, they abruptly fled to Jordan. They applied for resettlement in the U.S., but only Khulood and her sister were accepted. Her sister stayed behind to look after their chronically ill father, hoping to start a life in California to support her two relatives in Amman. Khulood made the decision to move by herself.
To the U.S., my friend, she received me and she offered me her place because the place for the refugees is not safe enough. Then I stayed with my friend there, and I thought that I can find a job because I can speak English and I have experience for almost 5 years in non-profit organization. But I found it's not that much easy, and lots of change or lots of things different from my country. So when I arrived, I tried to be involved in the community. At the same time, I tried to learn the accent, American accent, and at the same time, also, I have to find a job to go to see more people, to know the traditions. So this is lots of burden upon my shoulders.
Struggling to pay her own expenses, Khulood left California to be with her family. But not all Iraqi families have been able to reunite after they've been separated by the resettlement process. Khizran's second oldest son, Mohammed, he speaks of himself as an orphan, referring to his father's absence.
God forbid I feel like an orphan. Yes, my mom tries to make up for everything, but I still feel like an orphan not having my father with us. When my father was resettled in Austria, I had hopes that we would all be reunited after 6 months. The first year passed, then the second one followed, and the third, and I started to feel that hope has been destroyed.
The breakup of families has resulted in an overrepresentation of households led by single mothers. This change in family structure has strongly affected women, who now find themselves either the primary or the sole heads of their households.
I am the mother and the father now. When my children get sick, I have to take them to the doctor late at night. In our cultural traditions, it's frowned upon to have women get in taxis late at night. When my children were in jail, I had to look for people to help get them out of prison. When I returned from the police station late at night, the neighbors would not like it. We receive aid, but I also work with NGOs.
Khizran, whose name means bamboo canes, weaves baskets and sells them in downtown Amman. Through various NGOs, she facilitates workshops, sharing her weaving skills with other Iraqi women. With dwindling financial reserves, little to no income, many can deposit the equivalent of more than $70,000 into an escrow account to obtain Jordanian residency or work permits. Many Iraqi refugees work illegally to meet their day-to-day financial needs. Others volunteer at NGOs. To better serve the Iraqi population, international and local aid organizations offered Iraqi refugees, mostly women, a small stipend in exchange for volunteer time. This play on semantics allowed refugees to gain an extra allowance to complement the aid they receive.
Because women, more so than men, are better equipped to enter homes and build relations with families, and because they are already familiar with the community. The aid organizations relied heavily on Iraqi women to volunteer.
Dr. Jalal Damra, deputy director of the Institute for Family Health in Amman, is one of the few observers to have followed the situation of Iraqi refugees in Jordan from an early stage. He notes that aid organizations rely heavily on Iraqi women volunteers to conduct door-to-door data collection and need assessment surveys.
This allowed for men to rely on their women for income, in addition to the fact that women are less likely to be targeted by the police while working.
The constant struggle to secure income for their family needs can push some women into situations they never would have imagined. The founder of Bushra Institute for Research on Women, Jihan Nurjan, says that Iraqi women are bearing a disproportionate burden of the family responsibilities.
It is a big responsibility. If women don't have the strength to bear this responsibility, many of the women have nervous breakdowns. They not only work as volunteers, but many also work as domestic servants. Some sell cigarettes on street corners, while others engage in sex work to secure income for their children.
Ibtissam is a single mother of a newborn baby girl. She used to sell cigarettes on a street corner in the Balad in downtown Amman. Ibtissam's husband abandoned her when she was 4 months pregnant. We met her at an Iraqi restaurant and nightclub, where women, Iraqi, Jordanian, Moroccan, and Eastern European, meet clients.
When I don't have anything, what else can I do? I have a daughter. My husband left without telling me. I don't know if he's dead or alive. I have to take this path against my will. What can I feed my daughter? I'm not prepared to die of hunger. I need to pay for rent, food, medical bills, diapers, and milk for my daughter. I have no hope that I can live without this.
At the nightclubs, the women sit at tables headed by stern-looking madams, holding flavored tobacco water pipes in one hand and whiskey glasses in the other. They eat dinner provided for the female workers free of charge. When the music beats loud, the women get up and dance to Iraqi live tunes. At dawn, if they found a client, they negotiate a price and leave together. The price ranges depending on the club. Without anyone to look after her daughter, Ibtissam takes her 35-day-old baby to the clubs. The baby sleeps in a seat next to the table as Ibtissam and Rima, a Jordanian madam, and her 20-year-old daughter, Rima, spot clients. Ibtissam and Rima met at a friend's house.
She was visiting my friend. She saw me and liked me. She asked me for my phone number. She was well-dressed and seemed respectable. I thought to myself, why not? I should give her my phone number. I should see the world with her instead of staying home getting depressed.
Dr. Damra from the Institute of Family Health says the absence of traditional familial control, a watching eye, he calls it, combined with a feeling of exclusion in the new community, plus the lack of employment and effective aid, push refugee women to seek financial stability through sex work.
When looking at sex work, it's important not only to look at this phenomena, but to look at why this phenomena is happening. What caused it? Sex work is not only present in the Iraqi refugee community, rather, it's present in most refugee communities. We see that refugee communities are one of the most at-risk communities. The socioeconomic circumstances lead women to seek income through these means.
Jihan Nurjan from the Bushra Institute for Research on Women says that women working in the sex industry are particularly in need of a support system since they run such a high risk of becoming ostracized from their own communities should acquaintances discover the source of their income.
Here at the center, we worked to fight this. We worked with women who came here and explained that they are stigmatized and people do not interact with them. That exclusion is partly why they continued to work in the sex industry. We accepted the women and took them as our own. We provided them with alternative jobs, and many of them were able to get themselves out of the problems they were in.
Even the Iraqi women who are able to leave the sex industry behind still have to cope with the stigma of being an Iraqi refugee, with a homeland still torn by occupation.
You are listening to Guests in the Waiting Room, Iraqi Refugees in Jordan, a special FSRN documentary produced by Hanan Tabara and Salam Talib. To hear this and other FSRN documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org. Stay with us.
Khayzaran's son, Muhammad, describes a different kind of stigma associated with being a young Iraqi man seeking asylum. After the November 2005 bombings of three major hotels in Amman, which were carried out by a group of Iraqis with reported ties to Al-Qaeda, Iraqi men in Jordan came under close police scrutiny. Iraqi men ages 17 to 35 were especially targeted. By that time, Muhammad and his family were living in Jordan on expired visas. Both him and his brother received a letter by accident asking them to report to the nearest police station.
We received a letter asking us to report to the police stations. They had my brother's name confused and had the wrong descriptions about us. They thought I was 27 years old. They let us go the first time. They later called and asked me to report to the station again. I went. The officer asked me what my name was, so I told him. He said, "Prove to us that you are the right person." So I gave them the asylum seeker card that I have. He crumpled the paper and threw it at me.
Muhammad and his brother thought they were going to the police station to clear up the confusion over the letter.
We entered the small gate, and the police officer greeted me by asking me to take my clothes off. I told him that I wasn't going to do that. I told him that if he wanted to search me, he can go ahead. I will take off the belt and other things, but not my clothes. So he went ahead and searched me.
Muhammad and his brother spent the next 3 months in jail for overstaying their visas.
They treated me like a terrorist, like a criminal. They had me handcuffed inside a cage. I was in a car for criminals, and I haven't done anything wrong. A police officer was in the car with me, and there were two police cars, one in front and one behind me.
With the help of a local human rights organization, Muhammad and his brother were released. Most Iraqis in Jordan fled their home country in fear, but the security many hope to find remains elusive. Dr. Jalal Damra explains that many feel trapped.
Many of them say that we live in a prison, but this is a big prison. I ask why. They say because they live in a society where they are unable to go around, and they can't leave this country either to go back to their home country.
With an ever-changing reality on the ground, most Iraqis live in a state of limbo.
I feel like I do not belong in society because I carry the Iraqi nationality. That is reason enough to be hated. Now, when people ask me what country I am from, I reply that my nationality is Muhammad, my name. In all honesty, I don't feel like I belong anywhere. The blood that runs through my veins doesn't belong to any country. It belongs to myself only. I am my own kingdom.
Muhammad, who stopped attending school, told us that he also quit seeing friends.
My life is basically staying at home. My night is day and my day is night.
Tired of making friends and having them leave, Muhammad no longer answers his phone calls.
I had over 300 friends. The smallest group photo I had was with 32 people. But we all got scattered. Many of my friends were resettled to either the US, Australia, or Europe. There were entire weeks we spent saying goodbye to friends every night. It was painful. Every day I make friends and they leave. It was the same routine. So I stopped making friends. Now I don't answer my phone because I know what my friends are going to tell me when I pick up. They are going to tell me that they are leaving in a week.
Many young Iraqi men who've overstayed their guest visas have to live in the shadows, afraid of being stopped by the local police. They spend most of their time indoors. Many describe a dull, repetitive life of routine. They sleep most of the day and watch the news and worry about themselves and their families at night.
Now my life consists of the same days repeating themselves. The only difference is that one day will be sunny and the other might be cloudy. Those days translate into weeks that I've memorized.
Dr. Damra explains that after poverty and the lack of educational opportunities, another challenge that Iraqis face is social exclusion.
They are aware that isolating themselves from the rest of Jordanian society is a problem. It's a symptom of other problems. But they are unable to engage with the rest of society because they are afraid. So they sacrifice social inclusion in order to live in safety. I've been working with the Iraqi refugees in Jordan since 2003. Many of the cases that I work with, when I ask them, who do you live with, they say, I live by myself. When I ask why, they say, I don't trust anyone. Because of the circumstances that Iraqis have lived under, be it under the former regime or during the occupation, they do not trust.
Years of war continue to wreak untold damage to the physical and mental health of Iraqis. Dr. Damra says many Iraqis suffer from chronic diseases such as high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes. Many can't afford treatment at state-run Jordanian health facilities and have to turn to underfunded clinics provided by aid organizations.
Many have to wait 4 or 5 months before their turn comes to receive these services. Here at Noor Al Hussein, we provide health services. But honestly, not all the needed and important medicines and services are available to us. Why? Because there is lack in funding. We are funded by International Relief and Development, and the organization funds us according to the funds available to them.
The Institute for Family Health in Amman conducted a survey of 1,421 Iraqis. They found that many carry deep psychological scars of untold violence. Post-traumatic stress disorder and clinical depression were common, and the need for counseling is vast. Khayzaran, the Iraqi refugee woman raising her family as a single mother, agrees.
I wish we had access to counseling. I spoke to UNHCR and requested a therapist for my children. We are all still suffering. My children and I have had a phobia of the police. I always bring it up in discussions. I'm terrified that the police will drop by at any moment and take my children away from me. What happened to me shouldn't happen to any human being. For 2 months, I was living frantically, trying to get my children out of prison. One of the neighbors came once and asked if I had taken a look at myself lately. She told me to look at myself in the mirror and see what has become of me. I would go from UNHCR to the Mizan Human Rights Group, begging them to help my children.
For many Iraqis, the climate of fear has continued after fleeing Iraq. According to a report put out by the humanitarian organization World Vision, Iraqis, quote, fear for the future of their children. They fear being forced to return to the violence. And they fear those who murdered their family members to kidnap their children in Jordan. Dr. Damra says children absorb this climate of fear. He estimates that up to 27% of refugee children are clinically depressed.
Traumatic experiences are contagious. We see that Iraqi children who haven't experienced war trauma firsthand have depression, panic attacks, or PTSD. For example, when parents watch Iraqi news constantly, the children see that and experience their family's pain. When a car bomb goes off in Basra, the family calls up their family members in Basra to make sure they're okay. As such, We see that traumatic experiences did not end upon leaving to a safer place. Trauma for Iraqi refugees is still ongoing.
According to the forced migration report, for the first years of the war, Jordan was generally tolerant of the large numbers of Iraqis crossing its border. But as of 2007, visa restrictions limited entries to Iraqis with Jordanian residency permits and to those attending conferences or seeking medical care. Being undocumented, like many Iraqis in Jordan are, prevents them from settling down. Again, Dr. Damro.
As a Jordanian, I have my life more or less planned out. I know what my situation might look like in a year and maybe two, but Iraqis don't know what will happen to them the next day because their lives are temporary. Living temporarily is very painful. Why? Because it prevents them from thinking about the future.
Other Iraqis insist on taking an active part in shaping their future, one of unity and peace. Khaizaran gathered three of her female friends to stage a protest in front of the UN Refugee Agency's office in opulent West Amman. The four women stood with posters demanding reunification with their husbands who have been resettled abroad.
One of the security officers came out and told us that if we didn't go to our homes, they were going to call the police. So I put my poster to the side and I sat down. I told them to bring the police. I didn't come here with explosives, and I didn't come here to cause problems. I'm here to demand the right to be reunited with my husband. I don't have legal residence in Jordan. I want them to reunite me with my husband and resettle us anywhere.
The police came and mediated the situation, asking UNHCR representatives to speak with the Iraqi women.
A woman without her husband? What is that? She doesn't know if she's a widow or divorced.
Within a year of the protest, three of the four women had been reunited with their husbands. Khaizaran, the main organizer of the protest, smiled and told us that she's happy for her friends. But she still hopes for that long anticipated moment when her family can live together again. According to the International Rescue Committee, the United States had resettled 202 Iraqis in 2006. That number grew to 17,000 in 2009. While some regard the increase as encouraging, others say the U.S. should take more responsibility in ending the occupation and paying to help resettle refugees.
Today's documentary, Guests in the Waiting Room, Iraqi Refugees in Jordan, was produced by Hanan Tabara and Salam Talib. Special thanks to Reem Kathuda of Awam.org, Arab Women Active in the Arts and Media. Shannon Young was the documentary editor. Scott Pham was the technical producer. The music featured in this program was from Munir Bashir and Hamza El-Din. Tune in tomorrow when we take a look at India's Maoist rebel movement. This is Free Speech Radio News. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.